From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor for the New Statesman, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, and our moderator is Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Thanks for joining us. Here are the issues. Congress tackles another COVID relief bill. What kind of help can Americans expect from their lawmakers? Big tech goes to Washington. Lawmakers grill the CEOs of some of the biggest tech companies. We'll tell you what you need to know. And as protests continue across the nation, President Trump's attorney general defends sending federal agents in. And tensions increase between the world's two largest economies as China shuts down a U.S. consulate in the city of Chengdu. Finally, Congressman John Lewis, a hero of the civil rights movement, was laid to rest this week in his home state of Georgia, with lawmakers and the American public paying their respects. Emily, Jonathan, thanks for being on. Big, big stories this week. Let's start with the biggest story of all, the coronavirus and what Congress is doing or not doing to provide relief to the millions of Americans who are struggling. So, Emily, the Republicans have presented their plan for the next coronavirus stimulus bill, the HEALS Act, which stands for Health, Economic Assistance, Liability Protection, and Schools. It is quite a mouthful, but tell us exactly what they're proposing.
Well, so the issue is that there's a huge gulf between what the Democrats are proposing and what the Republicans have proposed. Democrats have a $3 trillion plan proposal, whereas Senator Mitch McConnell's own proposal is $1 trillion. He unveiled that on Monday. And there are even some in the Republican Party who say, no, that $1 trillion is too much. And the Republican version would leave out the money for state and local governments and the Postal Service and food assistance that the Democrats have been pushing for. There are other sticking points, like whether you give another $600 per week unemployment benefit, you know, if you give the same amount to everyone, if not, how much? Republicans are saying, well, we want liability protections for businesses who could be sued by employers and customers. And Democrats are saying, well, what about the workers and consumers? Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House this week, compared it to two different zoo animals of two different species trying to mate, bringing these two bills together. So
yeah, Congress is not very good with metaphors.
Right. So she offered up that tortured metaphor. But the point is that these are far apart and time is running out. And the group that's going to lose out if these two can't find a way to speak to each other is the American public.
Jonathan, as Emily pointed out, time is running out. Congress is coming up against the August recess when lawmakers go on a long break. And you also have new figures coming out that show the U.S. economy shrank over 30% last quarter, so from April to June, the largest decline on record. Unemployment numbers continue to go up as well. How much pressure are we seeing on lawmakers now to get something done?
Well, there's a great expectation on the part of the American people that something will get done. For example, the unemployment benefits that people have been getting under the previous rescue plan or stimulus plan, they expire today. So what we've heard is that, and this is from the number two person in leadership of Senate Republicans, Senator John Thune of South Dakota, he's basically said that it's very possible that they will not reach any sort of agreement and that they will have to do a very scaled down version.
There's a lot of anxiety right now among Americans, and they do want to see lawmakers do something and not just go to recess without having a bill passed. But Emily, I want to go back to what you said about how some Republicans are not even agreeing with what's in their own party's bill. Why not? Why aren't Republicans united around their own bill?
I mean, I think some of them think that even $1 trillion, as opposed to the Democrats, $3 trillion is too much. This is what Secretary of the Treasury Steven Mnuchin said. We don't want to pay people to sit at home. But of course, you're not paying people to sit at home. You're paying people because businesses can't safely open because there's a pandemic. And then there are things like there was Pentagon funding in here. And well, why was there Pentagon funding in the draft of a coronavirus relief bill? So I think that it comes down to how much Congress is willing to spend and on what they're going to spend it, right? Is it on trying to get people to stay home, or is it about making sure that businesses, if they are reopening will not get sued, which is the Republican proposal.
And Jonathan, you wanted to jump in here?
Yeah, I just want to jump in. President Trump has included in the bill something like over $1.8 billion for a new FBI headquarters, which just happens to be located across the street from the Trump International Hotel. The feeling is that he doesn't want the FBI to have a new headquarters outside of Washington, which was the original plan, because the location of where the FBI building is right now, the outdated FBI building, would become an open lot and developers could build a hotel there that would compete with the Trump Hotel. Now, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has said he's against this.
Right. Republicans seem to be surprised that that's even in the bill. It doesn't seem like that's going to actually be part of the final bill here. But you bring up the president, and Emily, I want to ask you, where is the president on these negotiations, or do Republican lawmakers want him to sort of stay out of it?
One gets the sense that they would almost rather he stay out of it because when he comments, it's not always in lockstep with Congress. And as far as I can tell, the comments that the president has made on coronavirus relief funding, as with his comments on coronavirus in general, have not necessarily been on message. So I think we should think of this as we spoke about divisions in the Republican Party. It's not like all of the Democrats are singing from the same hymn book either, but there are various Democratic voices on Congress, various Republican voices in Congress, and then there's the Trump administration. And for that matter, then there's Trump himself.
Right. A lot of moving pieces here and a hard deadline to get something done. But Jonathan, you know, putting aside an economic relief bill, just looking at the numbers of coronavirus cases in this country, we've reached over 4 million cases. Over 150,000 Americans have died in recent months because of this virus. The numbers don't look great. They don't look like they're getting any better. So are we hearing any new type of strategy coming from the White House?
In short, no. It seems as if the White House has basically become bored with this issue. Trump is totally focused on his reelection effort. One astounding number, I mean, you mentioned the number of the 4 million cases in the United States. 1,000 people are dying a day, and I think something between 66,000 and 70,000 cases, new cases, are arising every day. In short, this pandemic is out of control in the United States. That is the opinion of many medical experts. Some of the methods that were used or was suggested to be used, lots of testing, contact tracing, using of masks, well, particularly the tracing and the testing, they feel that the pandemic has gone so far now that those methods are no longer possible. What the federal health authorities are basically saying is everybody must use masks, wash their hands, maintain a 6-foot distance between each other. These are the ways that are going to bring the numbers down. But you have members of Congress like Louie Gohmert of Texas. He never wore a mask, very defiantly didn't wear a mask. And now he has come down with COVID-19. And he has said that the reason why he caught it was because he was wearing a mask. In other words, this whole issue of mask wearing has become politicized. It's a political issue now. It's an identity issue, as opposed to being strictly a health issue.
Right. And as you pointed out, a lot of smart people are looking at what's happening in the U.S. and they don't see the U.S. being able to contain the virus. And another lockdown is probably not politically viable. And that basically, we're going to have to toughen it out until there's a treatment or a vaccine. And on that front, at least, we do have scientists working with remarkable speed with a lot of federal money to support their work. Emily, can you give us a sense of where we are when it comes to a vaccine timeline?
So the positive news was that AstraZeneca and Oxford had an early study that seemed quite promising. Dr. Fauci had said that maybe at the beginning of next year, there would be some vaccine available. And by the spring or next year or a year from now, it would be widespread. So that, as far as I know, is the timeline that we're optimistically looking at. There are companies all over the world who are in the race to the vaccine, but part of the problem is that we're looking at this as country by country efforts. So according to the New York Times, at least 69 countries have banned or restricted the export of equipment, medical devices, and medicines, according to the Global Trade Alert Project in Switzerland. And the World Health Organization is already raising alarms that protectionism and nationalism are a risk here, right? Because getting to the vaccine is one, but we also need the distribution of this vaccine when it is actually discovered. So as a journalist, but also as a concerned citizen, have started thinking about the nationalism and protectionism and what that will do to the vaccine distribution timeline.
Right, because as we know, this pandemic doesn't respect borders, so this has to be a global response. Let's take a break here. We come back, we'll talk about lawmakers grilling the CEOs of some of the biggest tech companies, as well as tensions rising between the U.S. and China, and more. We'll be right back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, Emily Tamkin, U.S. Editor for the New States, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back. This week, Attorney General Bill Barr defended the federal response to violent protests that have broken out in Portland, Oregon, in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, an unarmed black man, by a white officer. Federal law enforcement officers have been sent in to control protests in Portland, and it has become a source of increasing tensions in the city. Now, though, Oregon's governor says federal agents will be stepping back from downtown Portland. First, Jonathan, for our listeners who may not fully understand the different law enforcement officers who've been operating in Portland right now, who are these federal police that have been sent in? They're not part of the military, so why are we seeing some of them wearing military-style uniforms?
I guess the correct way to refer to these people are federal agents. They come from the Federal Protective Service, they come from the DEA, and they come from Customs and Border Police. They've all been basically tasked to be riot police in Portland, also in Seattle, and they are not trained for this. There's a great consternation over the presence of these troops or of these federal agents. I say troops because they're dressed in what appears to be military uniforms, and the only identifiers that they have on their chest is a little band that says police.
Right, and it's very, we have to make clear that they're not coming from the U.S. military, even though
they look
like they are.
Yes, exactly.
There have been protests going on for weeks, as we mentioned, sparked by the death of George Floyd in May. And we did see some of the early protests around the country devolve into violence and looting. But then largely since then, we have seen peaceful protests. So what do you think has changed in Portland and Seattle, as Jonathan mentioned, where you're seeing violent clashes break out in recent days, tear gas and rubber bullets being used on protesters, protesters throwing rocks and fireworks at officers trying to set a federal courthouse on fire? What has happened in Portland specifically?
Yeah, I have to say that I think that the introduction of, and I don't want to sound too much like a child of the, I'm actually not a child of the 60s, so I don't want to sound too much like one in saying this, but I do think that federal agents being sent in when the mayor of Portland and the governor of Oregon had not asked for them to arrive and in fact said, we don't want you here, and tear gassing protesters added to and did not take away from the violence. I think that people fundamentally have a right to free speech and free assembly in this country. And I think that protesters in Portland and Seattle and across the country may feel that that right is being threatened, particularly by the Department of Homeland Security.
And you did have the president's attorney general this week defending setting these federal agents in, especially as you had protesters appearing to try to light a federal courthouse on fire. He said they were trying to protect government property. To that end, Jonathan, you have the president really trying to position himself as the law and order candidate as we come closer to the election. So can you give us some of the political context of what's going on here?
As you said, Trump is trying to position himself as the law and order candidate. So when protesters, and I must say a small minority of protesters, turn violent, as Emily mentioned, most of the protesters are nonviolent and peaceful. However, there is a small coterie of protesters on the far left and some on the far right who are very violent. This bodes very, very poorly for the peaceful demonstrations. I mean, we've watched this happen in the Arab Spring and in Hong Kong, where you have a large majority of peaceful protesters, but the violence by the small minority basically opens the way for strongmen and for authoritarian leaders to step in with force, with, in our case, federal agents. So it plays to Trump's strength. The violence justifies his argument and Bill Barr's argument that federal agents were needed because local authorities were not containing it. The way that protests work, at least in the United States, is when they are nonviolent and peaceful in the face of federal power, like the civil rights movement in the 60s.
Right. No, that's a very good point. And you're seeing an increasing argument from people on the left, even, that this small group of violent protesters are sort of hijacking and distracting from the larger message, which is something that many Americans support, which is police reform. I want to come back to hearing what's going on in D.C. for our next topic. This week, we saw the heads of the biggest tech companies, Apple, Facebook, Google, Amazon, grilled by lawmakers. They weren't actually in D.C. It was done remotely. CEOs were zoomed in like the rest of us have to do for work. But it's still a very big deal. It's the first time Jeff Bezos, for instance, was ever questioned by lawmakers. There have been rumblings, Emily, I know you've been looking at this, so I'm going to ask you questions about this. There have been rumblings about these big tech companies being too big and too powerful for a long time. So why do you think this hearing is being held now?
That's a great question. I think part of it, and this is just my own speculation, but I do think the part of it is that you look and you see Amazon and Jeff Bezos individually gaining a tremendous amount of money during this time that the rest of the country is not. So it makes it more obvious. I also think that the U.S. has kind of been, if you look at the EU and what Margrethe Vestager has done over there and the way in which she has tried to point out that American tech companies are too large, the U.S. is kind of behind on this conversation. And so this week was a kind of a catch-up week. And it was revealing. You had Jeff Bezos say that, well, yes, there's a policy that says that you can't use third-party seller data to support Amazon's own businesses, but maybe that policy has been violated. You had Mark Zuckerberg say that, basically admit that the reason Facebook bought Instagram was so as not to have to compete with it. And so I will be watching to see what lawmakers now do with this information.
Right, because there's been this, I think, year-long investigation by the House into the business practices of these companies. As you mentioned, the question is, what can we actually see legislation that's crafted that's effective?
I think that part of what is concerning is that I don't think, we were speaking about political division with the coronavirus relief bill, and I think that we will see, yesterday's hearing indicated to me that we will continue to see political division in this realm as well, because many of the Republican questions focused on bias on tech platforms against conservative viewpoints, which is a separate issue from whether or not these tech companies are monopolies. And so that kind of rift in focus, I personally think will curb Congress's ability to move forward on tackling this issue.
That's really interesting, right? Two different sort of views on what is important when it comes to curbing these tech companies, and can the two sides come together? And just on what Americans think, I wonder, because more Americans than ever are relying on these tech companies. We're stuck at home. We've got work meetings on Zoom. We're connecting on FaceTime. We're ordering packages from Amazon. But I feel like people are also resentful that they're so dependent on these companies. Where do you think public sentiment is, especially now with COVID?
I'll be honest, I think that most people aren't sitting around thinking about, is Amazon getting too big? Because I just think that most people are trying to get through this very trying time in all of our lives. But I do think that, and this is kind of what I was trying to get at the beginning of this little segment, I think that as tech companies get richer and more powerful and the rest of the country does not, that gulf becomes obvious, and that will bring about maybe not public resentment, but public interest in, well, wait a minute, why are these companies so big and so powerful, and why do they have this control over us? I also think that the question of data is going to become a more salient one. Americans are very particular about our right to privacy. Like, there's a reason that this is not Mark Zuckerberg's first time before Congress, right? So I think that will continue to be an issue for the American public.
Certainly an issue we're going to continue to look at. And one argument you hear from these companies against Washington breaking them up is that if they're weaker, Chinese companies will get stronger and more powerful. And I want to look now at this competition with China as the relationship between the world's two largest economies, the U.S. and China, has now taken a turn for the worse. China this week closed the U.S. consulate in the Chinese city of Chengdu in retaliation for the U.S. closing the Chinese consulate in Houston. Jonathan, I know you've been doing a deep dive into what's going on with China. So what is going on with China?
What's happening is that the background of the closure of the consulates in Chengdu and in Houston is that the over the past year or so, China has been moving very aggressively to secure a leading role on the global stage. We saw its assertiveness on display recently in Hong Kong, where a new law tightened Beijing's control over what used to be a semi-autonomous city. China's influence has also grown at the United Nations, where they Chinese nationals are the chairman and the director generals of four of the UN's 15 specialized agencies. They've also tightened their grip on the South China Sea, and they've ramped up their efforts to intimidate Taiwan, which they consider a breakaway province. They recently bloodied Indian troops on their shared border or disputed border in the Himalayan mountains. And they've waged a very interesting public relations campaign during the coronavirus pandemic to portray themselves as a model for others to follow in terms of containing the virus. Now, the United States has spoken out quite vocally emphatically against what China is doing. But aside from a few what they call freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea, it's really just been words. So what that does is the countries in Southeast Asia that also make a territorial claim to the South China Sea, as does China, they feel that, or they doubt, I should say, whether the United States will have their back in any sort of confrontation with China. Now, China...
Jonathan, I just because we have to wrap up, I want to just get one more point from you when you talk about allies. The U.S. can't go at this alone against China. They need ally support. And we are seeing some European countries move towards the U.S.'s position on China. But now you have the president deciding to withdraw 12,000 troops from Germany because he says Germany won't pay up. I wonder, do you see the president potentially antagonizing an ally whose help America may need in containing China?
Absolutely. I mean, the main allies that the United States has in Asia are South Korea and Japan. And Trump has repeatedly said that they're not paying enough for the presence of American troops and the protective American umbrella. These countries are resisting paying the kind of money that Trump wants for that. And what this does is that because they are under the American nuclear umbrella and Trump is threatening to withdraw it, they will inevitably develop their own nuclear weapons.
And they may see what's going on in Germany and be concerned about what the U.S. might do with the troop presence in Asia right now. We have to wrap the show up, but before we do, I want to note that this week, Congressman John Lewis was laid to rest in his home state of Georgia. Lewis, a civil rights icon, respected by folks on both sides of the aisle and by so many Americans for the sacrifices he made to fight for equality and justice in this country. He asked that his final words be published in the New York Times on the day of his funeral, including this message to the next generation of activists. Though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. In my life, I have done all I can to demonstrate that the way of peace, the way of love and nonviolence is the more excellent way. Now it is your turn to let freedom ring. Those are the words of John Lewis, Congressman, who was laid to rest this week. That is all the time we have. Thanks to Emily Temkin, U.S. editor of The New Statesman, and Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly. This program is produced by The Voice of America, and I'm Shana Stewart. Thanks for listening.